Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I'm happy to welcome Dan Koch from the You Have Permission podcast. Welcome to Mindshift Podcast, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for reaching out to me. I'm glad that we got together, even though we don't really know each other. We've had a little chat before we hit the record button. I think this is going to be an absolutely fantastic conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think I knew it would be good when I was wearing like a metal band sweatshirt and you told me about your past in the metal scene. I was like, okay. Things are going to go well here.
Absolutely. And you said you're getting into more metal because I'm an old 80s metalhead from way back, still playing in bands. You're still playing in a band, or you got a hand in it?
No, I don't have a band anymore. I was in an emo band called Sherwood for 10 years, but now I'm just writing. My day job is advertising music as I transition into becoming a psychologist, which is what I'm in grad school for.
Yeah, you're doing a PhD in psychology. But I'm interested in your podcast because I was looking through the episode titles. It's absolutely fascinating. You're covering a lot of stuff. It sounds like you've just done a series on end times anxiety, talking to a lot of people. But a lot of the titles I came away with the impression that it was kind of coming from a progressive Christian point of view. Is that kind of correct? How would you describe it?
Yeah, that's right. Some terms I'm kind of throwing around very recently are like Christian minimalism, which I got from Philip Clayton at Claremont, the idea of like sort of what are the minimal claims that would qualify one as a Christian, and then I don't go too far beyond those minimal claims.
Yeah, barely hanging on.
Yeah, I mean, from one perspective, the way I would say it is like finding God through the Christian tradition, but with a healthy dose of theological humility. That's what I would like to call it. And just kind of like recognizing that there are a lot more ways. We have new ways of knowing things than people had back during the Reformation or the Scholastic era, when we had a three-layer universe that only had the earth in it. And so that's how I would try to say it. So minimally Christian, definitely theist, and a lot less clear about the differential claims to truth amongst religious traditions, and thoroughly pluralist in terms of I practice Christianity, but I do not feel comfortable making any kind of exclusivist claims that Christianity is right and the other ones are wrong. You know, obviously I believe it's most right insofar as I practice it, but even then, you know, we could get into it if you want, but even then I think there are limits to what I can actually know about other religious traditions.
I would say I was a progressive Christian for probably 5 to 7 years when I was a pastor in Portland, Oregon, back about almost 20 years ago now. I was deconstructing. I didn't realize I was doing it at the time, but I got in touch with guys like Donald Miller, Searching for God Knows What, Blue Like Jazz, Brian McLaren, A New Kind of Christian. I was reading those books. And what I see now, looking back on my journey at the time, is that I found they were giving me language to describe things I was experiencing at the time. So I was questioning a lot of I came up in fundamentalist and really hardcore conservative evangelicalism. I went to Bible college in Portland, seminary in Portland, very conservative Bible colleges and seminaries. And I was questioning a lot of things. And as I read these guys, I was like, yeah, actually I'm thinking a lot of this stuff. I can start jettisoning some of this stuff that I really thought I had to hold on to. So that was a really important phase in my life. I didn't stay there forever, but I see now looking back, 20 years later, it was a period where I moved from really thinking I had to hold on to all this stuff. I was jettisoning a lot of stuff. And then I got to the point where I'm like, okay, there's nothing left, So I would describe myself more now as an agnostic. I don't know if I'd say I'm an atheist. I still have a lot of questions about God and the Bible and things like that. So I'm not sure where you're at in your journey. It sounds like we've been in similar places for sure, though.
Yeah. I have two thoughts on that. So just in response to agnosticism, I think if I did not have religious experience, I would be a lot more likely to call myself something like an agnostic, but I do. I do have it. I have it in prayer. I have it fairly regularly. And from what I understand of other religious traditions and the experience of religious human beings over the millennia, it looks a lot like other people's religious experience. And so it would actually be dishonest for me to not, you know what I mean? Like, it would be weird for me to take agnosticism and just deny all this experience that I had. Now, there's really interesting questions about how much secret information about the universe am I getting in that experience? Mm. And that's where I want to be very careful. But then the other thing is, you're talking about, you know, McLaren and Miller, and I'm thinking early Rob Bell. Yep.
Velvet Elvis.
I wonder what you think about this. Here's kind of how I think of that trajectory. Basically, some of them are Gen X, but some of them are just like leaders of Gen X people, like McLaren is probably a boomer. Your Gen X and your generation, basically, you guys are the first ones to experience basically a market inefficiency that the boomers created. Mm. And the generation older than the boomers, of like a bunch of gatekeeping of information in conservative Christianity. And the Rob Bell, Donald Miller, McLaren, these guys come along and they're like, hey, actually, there's other stuff out there, but you're still kind of pre-internet explosion. So the internet exists, but people aren't just like going to Wikipedia the first second they have a question. Mm. And then the millennials come and it's a bigger generation of people. So the numbers are higher, and the Bells and the McLarens and all those guys, they pave the way for what is now, I think, like an epidemic of deconstruction. Mm. It's the same market inefficiency. It's the same thing that boomers and the older generations did of trying to keep their kids safe by protecting them from information about the wider world. But now it's impossible to do that because of the internet and Wikipedia and all of this stuff. And then also increasing diversity in urban areas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or people like yourself who change countries and realize, oh, there's no hegemony of American evangelical Protestantism. Like, mm-hmm. you know,
it doesn't exist.
Church going Christians are 5-10% of the UK. So you go, oh my gosh, the world is so much bigger than I thought. So the reasons that it's bigger now than it was for your cohort are, one, population, just there's more millennials, mm-hmm. and Gen Z now, and two, it's the information shift of the internet and Wikipedia just becoming more and more second nature for people. I don't know. I've been talking for a while. So that's kind of how I see that.
It's good to get that perspective, because I think for me, now that I'm, again, looking back on it from 10, 20 years later, one of the things that I realized, and I've been realizing this more and more lately, I've been studying a tremendous amount on dominion theology, Christian Reconstructionism. I've been doing podcasting, talking to people about this who are experts in the field. And what it's done for me, and I've also studied a lot of cult psychology. That's what I've been devoting my podcast to for the last year or so, looking at the cult psychology. And I started applying those principles I was learning to my own experience. And I found that I see it as a pawn in a much larger game, as it were. I was raised in fundamentalism. I was raised in the Bill Gothard cult. And I look at that now and I think, okay, so when I was deconstructing my own theology, I was deconstructing my context. Does that make sense? In the much larger context in which I found myself. So for example, I was raised in the Bill Gothard church, but what I found out is Bill Gothard himself was but a smaller player in the bigger Christian Reconstructionism field. So you put me in that somewhere, and I'm working my way out of all of these layers, I guess you could say. One of the things that I learned from Donald Miller that blew my mind at the time was that he said Christianity has become a formulaic religion. And when I read that, I thought, my God, it was like a crystal clear moment of aha moment. I thought, this exactly describes the faith that I've been living up to this point. It was absolutely a formula, but that's what I was taught you had to be as a Christian. So that's kind of trying to describe when I'm having these aha moments. I'm like, okay, I got to get out of that system, whatever that is, that I've been trapped and raised in and educated in. And I was a pastor at the time teaching people this stuff, you know, so I'm laying it out.
teaching them the formula like exactly. a math teacher. Yeah.
And when I'm yep. laying, I'm laying in bed reading McLaren and Millen, I'm like, my God, I've been a pawn in this game. I've been subject to a level of indoctrination, basically, by my parents, by my peers, by my pastors and teachers at Bible college and seminary. And you start to back out of that. You know, that was, I guess, my sort of path out of deconstruction. And now I'm more about the reconstruction, rebuilding that yeah. identity that who the person I thought I was for all those years, who am I? I don't even know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There's a lot in there. Three There's quick a lot. Thoughts.
Yeah.
One, I think the formulaic thing is right. And what I'm talking about, the market inefficiency of restricting information and gatekeeping is to protect the formula, basically. So this is the formula. We know that this is how our kids will be saved. There's this other information out here that makes people question the formula, but we have a prior commitment to the formula, so we will block that information.
Yep.
That's
you know, the party
how I
line,
see the mechanism.
Yeah. Whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Can't rock the
second
boat.
The second thing is like, so we're talking about contextualization, basically. What's interesting about white evangelicalism in the States is about as ahistorical in its claims as you find anywhere. Mm. It really wants to believe there was the early church, then there was a 1,500-year break, then maybe we've got Luther and Calvin, depending on our stripe.
Before another that, nothing happened.
Yeah. Another 500-year break, and then it's just us and our Bible.
That's
and
right.
the early church. We are the new early church, and yep. none of the history is important to understand that. And yep. that's, of course, false. We're all contextual, which leads to my third thought, which is, yeah, you were a pawn in that scheme, but I would argue that everybody is raised into some contextual thing in which they are also a pawn. I'm a little bit less into the word pawn because it assumes a chess master, a player behind that's moving all the pieces. I would say more like you're caught up in a giant weather system or something like that. Like your house is in this coastal town, but the hurricane is hitting a lot of coastal towns, right? Something like that. So, but we're all raised in that. So
sure.
a bunch yeah. of kids here in Seattle are now coming of age in a thoroughly secularized, but like kind of open to paganism and Wiccan stuff, and hiking is their religion, and progressive politics are their religion. They're going to have to do their own work to go, oh, that's not the only thing in the world. I met this person from Burundi that I went to college with, and they had a very different, you know. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, you can give yourself a little grace because everybody's raised in some kind of a system. The cult psychology thing is interesting. I'm very interested in finding the parallels and then finding the dissimilarities. It seems to me to be kind of a continuum, but that's
absolutely
now that's a fourth thought. So there's
yeah, but I've done episodes on the question, is evangelicalism a cult? And obviously that's a clickbait title to get people. But what I do is I go into Dr. Robert J. Lifton's 8 Markers of Cults. And I read his book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. And that blew my mind because I thought to myself, as he goes through each of the 8 markers, well, he was talking about brainwashing in communist China, and then he applies it to the world of the cults. And I thought, okay, I could correlate each one of these 8 to my own evangelical experience. The reason I use the word pawn is because Lifton uses the word, he calls it the psychology of the pawn. So in his concept of what he calls mystical manipulation, your experience of God, in air quotes, may have actually been down to mystical manipulation, where you were a pawn. And like, for example, yeah. I was talking to a friend of mine for another podcast, Chris Shelton, who's an ex-Scientologist, and we compared Scientology with my experiences of evangelicalism going through Lifton's 8 markers, and the parallels were shockingly they were right there between the two religions. And we're thinking, why is this? There shouldn't be, but there was, you know? So the psychology is fascinating.
Yeah. I pulled it up to look at these. This is interesting. I'd need to spend some more time on, cause they're more complicated than, I mean, of course they are.
Oh, absolutely.
If you did real work.
You did.
But there's also a difference. Like one thing that I keep coming across in my own work on the podcast and then the research that I did on the end times and mental health stuff, I was raised in like a chill version of evangelicalism in California. you know, kind of a vineyard,
California cool like, thing.
Yeah, yeah. Like, hey man, like at the end of the day, it's really about God's love through Jesus, but also, you know, we're participating in this cultural zeitgeist right now. Mm. But like, you know, my dad was a therapist, it still is 40 years. Neither of my parents were fundamentalists there, but there were fundamentalists in our orbit, like in my Christian schooling, some of the teachers were, I would say, were fundamentalists. Mm. So that's where, to me, it's again, a kind of a continuum. You can come up with a lot of these continuums of like intense to mellow. And I have been very, I have felt more and more fortunate that I really wasn't raised with fundamentalism. Not really.
Yeah, you're lucky.
I am lucky. I am incredibly lucky. And in my therapy practice for the rest of my life, I look forward to having clients who were raised that way and helping them process that. Right. And so I want to be careful about evangelicalism itself is very, very broad. I mean, at its zeitgeist, it's maybe 30 or 40 million Americans, and they're not all in a cult. Like,
sure.
They don't all have, they're not all being sort of mind controlled by their pastor, but some of them are.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely.
And so if we can figure out what that looks like, then we can control for our experience with that as like the test case or the perfect example. And then we can go, oh, in this way, this was really healthy. But in this other way, the way that my pastor is reframing the words I'm using to fit his, you know, whatever, we can go, oh, that's some spiritual abuse right there.
Exactly. Religious trauma syndrome, rapture anxiety, spiritual scrupulosity, and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
these are all things that I experienced growing up, you know?
So you're ahead of me, man. You've been doing this for some years now, and I'm just catching up.
Yeah. Well, what my analogy of it is, it's like a Venn diagram, because my conclusion was, yes, evangelicalism cannot possibly be a cult. It's too large. It's not a monolith. There's not a single leader. On and on down you go. But it's a Venn diagram, I would say. There's overlap where if you say, okay, let's take, as defined by sociologists and psychologists, the classic markers of cults, at some point, the evangelical circle overlaps that. To what extent, we're not entirely sure. There are churches out there that are absolutely abusive and, as you say, cult-like. Yeah. But as a movement, it's too broad, it's too diverse, it's too big to be labeled as a cult. But I find a lot of people resonate as I talk about the psychology of it. They go, yeah. Because one of the things I learned talking to a lot of ex-cult members is they said, in terms of your reconstruction, what you need to do is unpick the conditioning. So find out how you were controlled. Find out how you were manipulated by the leader, the pastor, the cult leader. And that disempowers it tremendously. And that's kind of the journey that I've been on, I guess, the last year or two, is unpicking the psychology behind what happened to me. And I find that that resonates with a lot of people.
I don't doubt it at all, man. Mm-hmm. That sounds like really great and important work. And I want to be clear that, like, the type of faith that I have today is one where if it takes you being agnostic to do that work, then fucking go for it. Like, then you have to. Like, I don't believe in a God that would want to keep you in line and mentally suffering due to spiritual abuse so that you don't, cross one of the rule lines or something like that. Like that picture of God has thankfully been entirely expunged, 98% expunged from my mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so a bit of my story is that I have panic disorder. Mm. So I've had anxiety my whole life. It is what I like to say, it's in remission right now. I haven't had a full-blown panic attack for years, but I'm on some medication and I am aware of it still. And that's been more the lens that I've looked through a lot of this stuff in my own life is like, so how did this bad theology or whatever it was, how did it activate my anxiety such that then I bought in wholeheartedly to calm my anxiety? Like, of course, I need to get to equilibrium. So what do I got to do to get this anxiety down? And it's also been very helpful to recognize the patterns of panic attacks and anxiety and how these things work. And then that, like you're saying, that removes some of the teeth from it. Figuring out how your leader was gaslighting you or whatever helps remove some of the teeth from what they were able to do and decondition you. Man, I'm just like I hold 100% cosign on your whole program here.
You're on board. Well, and that's the question. I think this is what I think a lot of ex-evangelicals or people who are deconstructing, they want to know the answer. And I'd be curious to find out what your take on it is. Whose fault is it? Who the bad theology, the gaslighting? Because if you can trace it back to God, then we got a problem. People have pointed this out to me. We've got our closed Facebook group, and I've got a friend of mine. He's from the Netherlands, but he went to seminary in the States. So he's got the American evangelical background context, deconstructed. Now he's back in the Netherlands, writing a lot. And every time I'll make a point about sort of my background, Josh, he says, hey, you're actually reacting out of that context. It's what you've been saying. Right. That's not a universal thing. You can't apply that to all of Christianity. It's You're coming from a fundamentalist background. That's the God that you're reacting against, as it were. Mm-hmm. So whose fault is it, though? Is it God's fault that there are toxic churches and spiritual abuse and sexual abuse and all the rest of it? Or is that humanity's fault for twisting something that was pure and now it's been corrupted? Can we get back to the pure, whatever that is? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, the boring answer is it can't be God's fault unless God is not good. That's kind of a truism, right? Mm. Like what we're really disagreeing about is what God is like, if God exists. Mm. So, but if God's good, like if, for instance, like let's just use, for example, this response to the problem of evil says something like, it is better for God to not intervene in evil instances and suffering because in the large scale, it is worth it to have free creatures that can choose genuinely. Now,
you can love him or not. Yeah.
Yeah. You may or may not buy that, but if that's true, then in fact, it is worth it. And it's not God's fault, right? So in a sense, like metaphysically, ontologically, is it God's fault? It kind of can't be God's fault unless God is evil. Which
that's
is possible.
Part of his character. Yeah. Somehow.
Right. It's possible that God's evil. I think it's unlikely that God is evil. I think it's pretty likely that people, I mean, it's clear that people are involved in quite a bit of evil. So I would say, whose fault is it? I mean, it's interesting. I like the mantra, be tough on systems and easy on people. Mm. Because we are, as I said, we're born into all these systems. We don't choose them. And so if you think about the trajectory of any particular human life, it's to be born at place and time X, into systems A through Z, all of which are swirling around them all the time. They didn't choose any of that. Now, they make choices in their life, which will either keep the shitty systems going or they'll get the better systems going. Mm. You know, like, so that's kind of that's how I see it working. So it's a little bit everyone's fault for participating in the bad system. It's more the people who benefit from the bad system's fault than it is the people who suffer as a result of the bad system, but still perpetuate it. Mm. It's like, it's insanely nuanced, right? It's like, if you know Bronfenbrenner's systems, are you familiar with it? It's a concept in like psychology and sociology that like in the middle, you have the person, I'm going to kind of butcher it, but like, for any person, like here they are in the middle and the center of the sort of concentric circles is their own beliefs and their personality. Then you have their family. Then the next layer is like their neighborhood and the place they happen to live and what those other people, how they influence. Then the next one is like their religious tradition, which is bigger than just their neighborhood. And maybe their schools and stuff like that. Then the next one is like their nation. And then you take that, like now it looks like a target. All those things are interacting. They're causal arrows pointing both ways, mm-hmm. each in and out of all those. And then turn that thing on its side and do it through time. And now make it look like a cookie dough roll or a mm-hmm. paper towel roll. Then time is a factor because if you had been born here instead of there, all those things would be different. Right. So slavery is abolished versus slavery is still legal. You know, all those systems are going to change quite a bit. That's sort of the place where everyone finds themselves, is in this giant swirl of causes. And so if it can't be God, if God's good, let's say we accept that if God exists, then God is good. If that's true, which you know, that might be false, but if that's true, and if people are in this massive vortex, then I would say it's all the things in the vortex, probably not God. But I also would say, like, if God's not good, then God probably doesn't exist, because then by definition, that's not God. I don't know. That gets really tricky.
Hey, everyone, we're just going to take a very short break, interrupting my conversation with Dan Koch, progressive Christian. I hope you're really enjoying this. I think what I get out of this conversation with a guy like Dan is that even though we might disagree on a few areas, let's focus more on having a respectful dialogue, exploring the possibilities. And that's the whole thing about deconstruction, especially coming out of evangelicalism or even fundamentalist Christianity, is that you have the freedom to ask questions. You have the freedom, or as Dan's podcast is titled, you have permission to explore the possibilities, and you might not stay in one place forever. I didn't. I spent about 4 or 5 years sort of in that progressive Christian camp, and then I moved on, and so I'm not in that place anymore, but that's where I was for a while. So I hope this kind of models what a good, respectful discussion can look like. Just wanted to mention what's coming up in the next couple of weeks here on Mindshift Podcast. I've got a fantastic interview with Dr. Marlene Winnell. That's going to drop next. We're going to talk about religious trauma syndrome. And of course, Dr. Winnell is best known for her book, Leaving the Fold, which came out in 1993. And I believe it was the production of that book and then subsequent articles that Dr. Winnell has written on the subject of religious trauma syndrome that's really given rise to naming this syndrome and then the studies and sort of therapeutical processes that have come out of that. So we're going to get into a discussion of where the subject came from and how it's developed since she wrote her book, Leaving the Fold. Now, Dr. Winnell was going to be one of the keynote speakers at my friend Janice Selby's Conference on Religious Trauma, the CORT 2020 conference, coming up in April in Vancouver, BC. Unfortunately, we've just received word that because of the coronavirus situation, that conference has been postponed. As far as I know, it's not been canceled entirely. In other words, they're going to try to hold it again at some point, hopefully when everything calms back down. So we're going to await word on what's going on. I know Janice is really disappointed because she had some fantastic speakers, some of whom have been on this show. Dr. Yanya Lalich, of course, as well as Dr. Marlene Winnell coming up next. So stay tuned for more information. I'll pass along anything that I learn in upcoming weeks as more episodes drop. I will be sure and let you know. You can also look at court2020.com for more information about what's going on with that conference. Now, I will say one last thing. You can support this show on Patreon. You can kind of pay me for all the work that I do in editing these podcasts and putting all these things together. I do all the work, and I really don't want to have advertisements on this show. I'm grateful for all the Patreon supporters that we do have so far. They are part of our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group, and that is one of the many benefits that you get for being a supporter of this show on Patreon. And that's really cool because every month we do a Zoom call. We just did last month's call with Claudine Gallagher. We talked about dealing with anger and issues like that around leaving a religion or a cult. This month, in the month of March, we're going to have Chris Shelton drop in, who is an ex-Scientologist. And in fact, we just did an episode a few weeks ago with Chris. If you haven't caught that one, that's a really good discussion about the psychology of Scientology. I'm also in talks with Conway and Siegelman, bringing them back in for another podcast episode, as well as another Zoom call when they get a little bit of time, maybe in March or April. So there's some really great stuff coming down the pipeline. Look for Marlene Winnell in the next couple of weeks, and then hopefully I'll be coming out with Conway and Siegelman at some point, as well as some other great content heading your way. I'm also really excited to be chatting with Andrew Knight and Matthew Taylor from the Still Unbelievable podcast. We're going to be talking about an article that I wrote on Medium about what happens when people leave the church, what happens after Christians leave the church, and there's a whole range, a whole spectrum of responses, and we're going to be getting into that as well. So I'm really excited to be chatting with those guys this week, and I'll keep you posted as to when that episode drops on their podcast. Just a final thought, if you have any questions, comments, thoughts, feedback, drop me a DM on Twitter. You can follow me at MindShift2018. You can also look up the MindShift Podcast Facebook page. You can get a hold of me there if you want to send me an email or contact me on Facebook. So let's jump back into the chat with Dan Koch as we continue our conversation with a progressive Christian. Well, the thing I appreciated about my kind of sojourn into progressive Christianity was the fact that you didn't, my take on it anyway, was you didn't have to have a position that was not indefensible, but this is me for all time. You have the freedom to question and change. And whereas the tradition I was raised in, you had to have a position, you had to have a theology, you were a Calvinist, you were an Arminian, you were a dispensationalist, you were a covenant, whatever it was, you know. And I remember sitting around in Bible college, as I'm sure you have, had all these arguments with your friends, you know, about whether or not you can lose your salvation or, you know, and all the rest of it. You think, my God, really? But that's where we had to be. I had to know at that point in time. It was really important to know whether or not I could.
Okay, so I just had a thought this morning, right on that line. If you're dialoguing with a fundamentalist, or if you're considering whether the fundamentalist picture of the world might be true, one way you might really oversimplify this is to say there are, broadly speaking, two options here to explain this experience. The first is that there is a good force and an evil force, and they are doing battle for souls left and right. Mm-hmm. And the people who have the secret knowledge and follow it. And so they have the secret knowledge. First of all, they're lucky enough to have it revealed to them. And second of all, they have the willpower to follow it. Those people are doing the will of the good spirits, and everyone else is an enemy and doing the work of evil spirits. Here's option B. People are full of anxiety in an uncertain world. And the way that they deal with that anxiety and uncertainty is they cling to certainties, whether they exist or not, that make them feel okay, that let them go back to equilibrium in their adrenal system and feel like they are fine in the world. If I have to choose between A and B, I'm going with B. Mm-hmm. That seems like a better description of the data.
More healthy.
Just like there are so many problems with A. How do you know you have the right secret information? Why? How do you know it's not Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam? How could you possibly delineate that? And number two for that is, like, once you learn about brain science, you understand that fear basically keeps the best part of our brain from working, the prefrontal cortex, where we get art and philosophy and all this stuff from. You're like cutting it off by running your adrenaline and your amygdala and everything. I'm not a neuroscientist, so, you know, I may be using those terms wrong, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I got to go with the latter, man. I think that people who cling to fundamentalist certainty are just trying to feel good in a crazy world. And I don't blame them for that. I understand that they're doing that. It is a crazy, uncertain, scary world. I don't agree with the truth claims that they come out of that with.
Well, I heard Dan Carlin on his Hardcore History podcast. He made a comment one time. He said, the thing about fundamentalism is that it offers a lot of prepackaged answers to life's big questions. And so for someone like you just described who's seeking certitude, man, that sure feels good to know that you're right and everybody else is wrong. And we've got the sacred science. This is going back to Lifton. You know, our text, whatever it is, the Quran, the Bible, the Old Testament, whatever sacred text you want to put in there, is the truth. And we are interpreting it correctly. Yeah. And just ask us and we'll tell you. In fact, you don't even have to ask us. We'll just tell you. And this is the other part of the question. How much of this is down to your hermeneutics? It's got to be how you interpret, in this case, as we're talking about the Bible. This is another thing that Josh has pointed out to me on numerous occasions, that the reaction that I'm positing is a fundamentalist hermeneutic. So I'm, the way I read the Bible, even now as an agnostic or whatever I am, is still, I can't help but see it through the lens that I interpreted the Bible through for my whole adult life.
Yeah, and this is what I think is going on with the, like, when Ken Ham, the creationist, debates Dawkins or whomever, the new atheist, they actually agree on how to read the Bible, and they just disagree on whether it's true. The frustrating thing about that is, like, there are also many other ways to read the Bible, absolutely, right? Like, I think of the Bible more like an organic outpouring of people as they relate to God over time. So that's a very different, you get something very different if that's what you think the Bible is. You're not looking for perfect information preserved by the Holy Spirit. It might be inspired by the Holy Spirit insofar as it's like, I believe, since I believe in God, and since I believe that I experience what I would call the Holy Spirit with Christian language, people who are doing that. And then over time, some of those writings are going to resonate with people more than other writings, and they're going to go into the liturgy. And as they are praying this stuff in synagogue every Saturday, some of it is going to stick more than other stuff. It's going to match their experience more than other stuff. And that's the stuff that people are going to remember. And then eventually they'll write that down, if it was oral tradition before. This is beautiful. I don't need to look to that for perfect information about, you know, the secret knowledge God has revealed to the people who happen to be listening. I can see it as like, oh, like a wisdom tradition, stuff learned over time. That's never going to be perfect, but does not mean it's nothing. Because if I leave, I was just talking about this with my wife yesterday. She's due. Our son is due in less than 2 weeks, our first child. And I'm stoked. But we're talking about, like, if we exempt ourselves from the church entirely, one thing we'll be doing is we'll be betting on ourselves to do something better than this 2,000 years of accrued wisdom has figured out. And there are problems with that 2,000 years of accrued wisdom.
Sure.
Don't get me wrong. Problems. But how many problems will we have going at it, you know, starting from scratch? This is, I don't know the answer to that. I'm saying this is the tension that we're dealing with right now. That's not an easy question to answer.
At least you're asking those questions. And of course, we've seen the other route. I get emails every week from a guy that he writes a blog post. He's a diehard atheist, ex-pastor, totally walked away from it. And his mission, and I'm sure you've come across, you know, the evangelical atheist in a way.
Yeah,
his goal, every blog post that he writes, every Friday he puts a new one out, is to disprove the Bible, to show how Christians are gullible, stupid fools, that the God of the Bible is a despot and cruel and et cetera, et cetera. And I think, okay, who are you trying to convince? I mean, maybe his fellow atheists are like, yeah, stick it to those gullible fool Christians.
Sure, yeah.
And I resonate with some of the stuff he says. Don't get me wrong. I think, yeah, I have a lot of questions too, but it seems so angry and so full of just bile. And you think, God, I mean, I don't see how you're going to win people over to your point of view that these Christians, let's say, that you're coming against, even if you're right, they're just going to double down. It's not going to work.
No, that's true. I mean, we all experience that with politics in the UK. Sure, it's with Brexit, absolutely. I'm sure. And here it's Democrats, Republicans, and Trump and all that. Yep. People do not change their mind when you simply present to them an argument. But I would also be curious, just riffing here, that is it A or B that we brought up earlier about, is it secret knowledge that I have access to, or is it a certain kind of thing, certainty, or is it I'm trying to avoid my own anxiety by doubling down on certainty? For a fundamentalist atheist, I'm going to go with B, because I don't think that the data, like, they perceive it as, well, it's science or it's Christianity. And that is, I mean, frankly, horse shit.
Either or. Why does it have to be black and white?
Plenty of scientists are Christians. You know, plenty of Christians are, like, plenty of theologians are incredibly informed by as cutting edge of science as they can possibly find. And they're in dialogue with physicists at Cambridge and Oxford. And you can put your head in the sand and ignore that to calm your own anxieties if you'd like to. But that's not intellectual honesty. That's coming out of, I believe that that's coming out of a place of personal insecurity. And I would recommend to that person therapy, not more reading, to figure out what the insecurity is about. You know what I mean? Like, Catholics, all Catholics officially accept evolution, and they are 2/3 of the world's Christians.
Mm-hmm.
2/3. So fundamentalist Baptists cannot possibly speak for Christianity as 6% of world Christians.
Sure they can.
If you believe in science, do the fucking ratios, man. Yep. You know what I mean?
Yep. But yet, going back to your comment about being within a context, so you get these kids that come up within, let's say, a more conservative, if not fundamentalist context, the system can set them up for a big fall. Because, for example,
100%.
Where the college that I teach over here in the UK, there's only one other American on the staff. We become friends. His name's Tom, and he's a geologist. And he came over from, he lived in New England, and then he lives over here in the UK. He teaches over here now. And we were talking about this the other day, and he said that when he was teaching in a college in New England years ago, he had some real fundamentalist Christian kids in his one particular class, and he was teaching on geology, and he was talking about fossils. And this one young woman raised her hand and said, "Excuse me, I don't believe in fossils." And he was like,
"Yeah,
wait, you don't believe in fossils? Yes, they're not. It's not true." And he went down this line. Turns out, you know, she's coming from this fundamentalist Christian home, young earth creation. You know the rest of the story.
I can fill it in. Yeah, right.
So that he said,
in my sleep,
tomorrow I'll bring some fossils in that I personally own, and we'll discuss them. He brought in some, you know, shark's tooth that was millions of years old. She dismissed it out of hand, refused the whole thing. The earth, that can't be true because the earth is only 6 to 10, you know, and you go, okay, where's that girl going to end up? Where's that young woman in a system like that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, so that's basically the purpose of You Have Permission. The idea is, as someone who does believe in God and who practices the Christian faith, I think that the Christian faith, if done in a non-fundamentalist way, is on par a big good for people in their lives. Mm. I could be wrong about that. That's my conviction. And I would like to avoid, whenever possible, people unnecessarily leaving the faith because of bullshit false binaries that they were given. Mm-hmm. We interviewed Science Mike McHarg. He does the Liturgist podcast for another podcast I used to do, actually called Reconstruct, of all things. Mm. And he said he was literally taught in his Baptist Sunday school growing up, either young earth is true or the Bible is lies.
That's it. Yeah.
That is.
What a dichotomy.
Fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Like, that's its own series of books, how a person could end up in a position where they say that, and hopefully they would be non-judgmental books. Mm. But like, okay, so that exists, and this podcast exists as a corrective, essentially, to that. Mm. So we lay out options, and broadly speaking, I argue in the aggregate, I'm sort of arguing, if you want to call it that, for a more progressive, liberal, really just kind of theologically and intellectually humble, I hope, Christianity, to avoid exactly that stuff. And we're, you know, as we have our son coming, and we also have a closed Facebook group that's awesome. By the way, if you're a podcaster, have a closed group. Open groups are not worth it.
It's true.
They're not safe enough.
No.
And people who don't care about the mission of the show and the community will unthinkingly just kind of derail everything. We have a list going of like children's books and appropriate Bibles. And like, well, do you guys use a Jesus storybook Bible? I've seen that a lot in my church. Actually, we don't, because it's full of penal substitutionary atonement
at every
opportunity. It's like hyper reformed. Okay. Mm. We're not going to buy that one. And you know, we're going to get this Desmond Tutu one. That feels better. You know, it's all discernment. I mean, all this stuff is difficult. Anyway, I feel like I'm on a tangent now.
Well, it's good that you're having those discussions. That's the thing, isn't it? You're not coming from that binary black and white thinking. And that, I think, you know, what I've been saying about my own background, that's got to resonate with a huge segment of probably your audience and mine as where people are, you got to go, what am I reacting against? What actually am I reacting against? Because you can just have a visceral knee-jerk reaction and say, this is all bullshit. One of the things I've learned in the Reconstruction piece is you've got to go back and sort of pick out the good. I look at I spent my whole life in academics, in ministry, as a pastor, going to Bible college, seminary. I did my PhD over here. And then it all went south. I lost my job. I got made redundant, as they say in the UK. I got laid off from this Bible college. And I see now they did me a favor, you know, but I can't just react to all of that. There's too much. I've got to go back. Yeah. And, you know, and one of the things I learned obviously from academics is critical thinking, whether or not it was Bible college or seminary. I wrote, you know, papers and read books and read articles, you know, as you would do in any education. So it's not all a bunch of bullshit that I want to jettison the whole thing.
Right.
So I have to go back and say, okay, I need to pick out, there's some worthwhile stuff in here. And it helps me to talk. I can talk about theology.
Right. Yeah.
On an educated level that most people can't, whatever that means, you know, we can have a discussion, you know.
How much pastoral work did you do like with a pastorate?
Oh yeah. I was a pastor. I was an elder and a pastor for 12 years.
So I think about is like, what about all the dying people you sat with and like funerals you were able to, you attended and like were a presence for those people, births you were able to attend. Like, you know, like one thing that's still true of pastors in our modern society and priests, and I think this comes out even in the show Fleabag, which is set in the UK, clergy are still, even now, on call for the moments in life that tend to like define life, give it its most meaning. That's gorgeous. And like, I imagine you felt, and even looking back, I would guess you would still think that of that as a huge honor, right?
Yeah. And I still feel like I'm in that pastoral role now doing what I'm doing. And I've talked to other ex-pastors. We've all agreed the same thing. We feel like we're still kind of in a pastoral role. This whole thing about, you know, engaging in dialogue with people like yourself and all sorts of people from all walks of life and helping them to deconstruct and reconstruct and move on and move past it. That's a lot of the stuff I was doing as a pastor. I just strip away the theological underpinnings of all of it. You know, I'm not saying, well, you need to pray more and you need to read your Bible more. That's what I used to say to people. Not anymore. That's not my advice anymore.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think of both the podcast and my eventual therapy practice when I finish school as ministry as well.
Yeah.
And that's the part that's the most privileging too. I really think it is. Like getting the email or the Facebook message and getting to talk with somebody about their story or occasionally in person at an event or something, like that's the best part of it. That's when you recognize there's a real connection here. And that is pastoral. And that is the thing that shamans, witch doctors, priests, medicine men, name it, over all human history, they have played that role. And that's another frustration I have with some of the tear it down type movements is like ignoring the fact that human beings seem to need somebody like that in their community and that that's a real role and has real value. That's another soapbox thing for me, I guess.
It really is. But I'm on that same soapbox with you, man, because for a long time, I was all about the deconstruction. I was angry. I was venting. I was ranting, as a lot of people do. You go through that phase. But then someone challenged me. She said, well, what about the reconstruction side? I'd never thought of that. You know, I was like, no, I'm on a mission to tear it all down and burn it all down. And I'm pissed off and I'm angry about what happened to me. And it's all a bunch of bullshit. It's like, yeah, but you can't sustain that anger. Well, you can, but it's very unhealthy. It's very toxic. What about helping yourself to build back up? And that's when I really kind of turned a corner about 2 years ago. And we did a live podcast one of the times I was in Seattle with this gal, Stacey Ray. She came down from Canada. We did this live thing and it was called Reconstruction After Deconstruction. And ever since then, that's kind of become the theme of my show is helping people to reconstruct their identity. And that's a huge piece. And that's pastoral, isn't it? Like you said, that's really what it is. I'm not a pastor. I am not beholden to any church. I'm not on staff anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to say anything that somebody doesn't want me to say. I can say whatever I want, you know? So that's a really freeing feeling, especially when you were in that system for years and years, you know, you had to watch everything you said, everything you did. Oh, so unhealthy.
Well, and I love that too, because, you know, let's say you were an avowed atheist, which is not quite where you're at, but you still said, you know what? I think my goal is to find people who have gone through this process that I went through and help them rebuild their lives so that they are not living lives fueled by resentment and anger, but about building something new in the place of it.
Sure.
If that's all we could agree on, I would say we're agreeing on quite a lot.
Happy days. We want you know, people like, to be healthy at the end of the day, yeah, don't we? I don't want people walking around toxic and angry and lashing out, and for whatever reason, they're pissed off. And rightly so. You know?
Oh, there's a lot to be pissed off about, for sure. Oh, yeah. But that's true of anybody in anyone's story, right?
Yeah. But I was for a long time, I was in a Facebook group that was a lot of people coming out of the church, and it really helped me at first because we were all ranting and venting, but the group became super toxic. And I ended up getting burned along with a bunch of other people after a couple of years, and I got out of there, and I thought, my God, that's just like what happened in the church. We just replicated that same dynamic. We're just wallowing in the rage and the bitterness and the anger. Yeah. It all is a bunch of bullshit. But it was all just festering, and it was just this unhealthy, toxic soup. And now I see it's a good thing I got out. I needed to get out, but I didn't see it at the time. Man, that was a good thing I got out.
Yeah, the labels are never exactly clear, but I have an episode coming out pretty soon about sort of the differences between ex-evangelical and post-evangelical. And I tend to identify as post-evangelical for the reason that it's like it's a bit more reconstructive, and ex-evangelical, technically there's the same thing in terms of the syntax, right? Former evangelical, after evangelicalism, whatever.
Yeah.
But there is a kind of a cultural difference, broadly speaking. Of course, not everyone who would put themselves in those things fits this, but broadly speaking, I'm less comfortable with just focusing on the negative part of it. And I think that partly that's my prayer life, right? Like the fact that I have a prayer life that exists, in which I feel God's presence, at least what people over the centuries have described as God's presence, makes it harder for me to just be angry about it all. Mm. Because actually for me, it took beginning contemplative practices for me to have the courage to deconstruct my own evidentialist paradigm of my faith. So what I used to say was, well, at the end of the day, if a reasonable person looked at the evidence, they'd be a Christian. That's what I used to say and think. I said it out loud.
I said it.
Yeah. And I needed to get out of that. And I may have been able to get out of it without this, but in my own story, what it was experiencing unconditional acceptance through prayer. That then I was like, oh, I'm okay. And now I'm free to question these paradigms.
That's surely a much healthier place to be, whatever your point of view ends up being. And it's in progress, isn't it? We're on this journey
for
somewhere.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Because one thing I've learned, deconstruction looks different for everybody. Our experiences weren't the same. You said you weren't raised in a hardcore fundamentalist home like I was. I was raised in a Bill Gothard. I see it now. It was absolutely a cult. There's no doubt about it. I think it fits all the markers, and that messed me up psychologically, sexually, and I'm still piecing that all together. That's why I'm doing so much work on cults and dominion theology and all the rest of it, because it's my story. And just it so happens that it's resonating with a bunch of people who are coming out of that. I got a message the other day from a woman that said she found my podcast about a year ago, and she listened to a couple episodes, and she said, I was too scared to keep going. I wasn't ready yet. She came back a year later and she's like, okay, now I'm actually in a better place. I can start listening to this stuff. And it's resonating where I'm at now, you know? So I think, okay, that's must say something about where she's at and where she's been coming from. Doesn't it?
I see that in my own story too, not having been raised fundamentalist, of like, oh, Peter Rollins and negative, you know, radical theology of like, hey, there's like really a lot of constructs here, and we can tear a ton of it down. Sure. And just like finding myself, okay, I think I'm ready to hear that now. And I really wasn't 2 years ago. And I haven't gone back to it yet, but I found myself thinking a couple times, like, yeah, I should probably pick up one of his books. Like, now I think I'm at a time to do that. And then there's people that I know who are like, not ready for some of the stuff that I'm ready for right now.
Absolutely.
And there are people who are ready for stuff that I'm not ready for. And
yeah, we're in different places and different spaces, surely.
There's a term in child development called zone of proximal development. And the idea,
ZPD. It's in teaching as well. Yeah.
You could apply that to adult stuff as well, where it's like there are things that are close enough to what we know that they seem possible. And when you combine that with like all the stuff around plausibility structures and like what percentage of your community believes something, the higher that is, the more likely it seems to you to be true, but of course some of that is arbitrary. Who do you happen to be around? You go down those paths, and this is what leads me to the robust pluralism, for instance. So I can't not be a theist. I can't with my experience and what I know. But I want to be like, I have to really recognize how contextual my life and my experience are. I was born in North America into a moderate but really believing Christian family. So I'm very likely, if I'm going to experience God at all, it's going to be through Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were born into a Taoist family in 1520, I would not experience it through Christianity. There's just zero chance that I would. And I have to take that very seriously, because that's like undoubtedly true. And so I at least need a God who is big enough or whatever to sort of make that work. Otherwise, what we basically end up with is religious colonialism and imperialism. And we've seen the fruits of physical colonialism and imperialism and militaristic and economic over time. And that's bad fruit. And not to mention, Jesus is roundly rejects that shit anyway in the actual gospel. So I think it leaves me with just following those paths of like, yeah, we're so contextual. I have so little access to like universal claims about things. I just have to chill out on my particular claims.
It's definitely a needed corrective, because, you know, with the stuff I'm studying with, let's say, for example, dominion theology and a lot of the stuff that's going on in the Trump Evangelical Advisory Board, their view, it's very much a Christian colonialist view in a way, because what they're essentially saying is we need to have dominion over the whole world. Christianity must reign supreme until that happens, Christ won't return. You know, so it's the exact opposite of everything you just articulated so clearly. Yeah. And this is what's going on in a large part of American evangelicalism right now today. So we need the correctives of shows like yours, for sure. It sounds like
it's just so interesting to think about how much more I agree with you than a Christian person who is on that stage.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, we just had Kanye West, Awake in 2020, a couple weeks ago in Arizona, man. A bunch of Dominionists on there with Kanye West, you know, with 60, 70,000 people soaking it all up.
It's going on right now. Yeah. And it's just like, I do sort of wonder, like, what's the use in the word Christian at that point? Like, or just the variety. I don't know that Christian means much as a term by itself. I think delineating the differences between what I believe and what they believe, that's meaningful. And you could get a lot of helpful information from
Absolutely.
That. Just the fact that we both call ourselves Christians, I think is probably pretty meaningless.
Mm-hmm. When you actually break it down. Well, I'm talking to Chris Shelton again, the ex-Scientologist friend of mine, you know, and I was saying, you go through like the Seven Mountains Dominion Theology. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's...
I don't know a lot of... No, I thankfully...
It's bizarre. Yeah. I did an episode not long ago where I likened it to like a video game. It's so bizarre. You could turn it into a whole video game, you know, demons on top of these mountains, and you got to fight your way up the path and, you know, displace these demons atop the mountains. That's what they think they're doing. That's their version of Christianity. I mean, it's akin to Scientology and Xenu, and it's a science fiction version of Christianity, and yet they're the ones doing it right now, you know? So yeah, you could talk about the differences. It's so stark. It's unbelievable how different it is.
It's just like we both use Jesus of Nazareth as an avatar for what we're talking about, and they're almost the similarities end.
You've used him for your own ends, and that's... But historically, throughout history, that's been the case, hasn't it?
Well, especially the more imperialistic and colonialist you get.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm sitting here in what used to be the British Empire, you know? Yeah. So they were seeing themselves as going right along with the aims of the British Empire.
But what's interesting about that, I think that that's also a window into how we can't be so dismissive of religion. Because, for instance, where have we gotten the critiques of colonialism? We've gotten them from Black Americans and from Latinx theologians in South America. They've come from the marginalized communities that were racked and hurt the most by Christian colonialism and imperialism. And they read Jesus far more literally than these Dominionists do.
Absolutely.
And they'll say, oh, we're all about a literal reading of Scripture. Fucking bullshit you are. Mm-hmm. You are not at all about – you don't take it's harder for a rich man to get through the eye of a needle or, you know, good to heaven than a camel through the eye of a needle. You don't take that shit literally.
No.
You will do anything you can to obscure that. And where we get the literal take is from these people who have been brutalized. And I think about the civil rights movement in the United States in the 60s, 50s and 60s coming out of the black church. And there's something so Jesus-like about that. And so that's where I want to hold on to it is like, I want to hear from these voices who are decolonizing theology. And my gut is they have a far better understanding of where Jesus is coming from than do the people who have the biggest microphones and megaphones right now in America. But that's another reason for me to like kind of stay in because like, well what are someone's they talking about?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's so interesting. Yeah. When I was teaching at this Bible college over here, I used to go to Leeds every week. I taught Wednesdays and Thursdays up there at a center, and all the students were all from Africa. Absolutely fascinating. And the interesting thing, you talk about context, I had 30 students, let's say, first and second year Bible college students, and I'm teaching them Old and New Testament and theology. And their theology was white, fundamentalist, evangelical, American Christianity.
Yeah, exported.
And the theology I was teaching them was also white, British. And I would say to them, now you realize that what I'm teaching, I had to teach sort of prepackaged notes, which was one of the problems I had with it, was it wasn't for my material. I was required to, because they had to be taught, all the centers across the UK had to sing off the same hymn sheet.
So you're basically like the manager of a like auto plant, and your job is to make sure that they make the doors this way. Yeah. And that's it. You're just quality control.
It was not a franchise. Yeah, essentially the center, the control that was in one city, and they would give you all your material so that every student would submit the same papers. And we would go through the various interpretations of a biblical passage, let's say, and I would read them. We'd go through the same passage. I would read, like you say, a liberation theologian from Latin America, or I'd read an African theologian from South Africa or somewhere. Radically different interpretations than the stereotypical white Protestant WASP sort of thing. And that was their interpretation, though. I'd say, where are you getting yours? Well, we got it from the missionaries that came from America to Africa. Right. And that's the gospel that we know. That's the version that we know. And I would say, guys, come on. You've been played, man. You don't realize what's happened to you. You know. And yet the pushback that I would get sometimes was, I'd get them to question things, and they'd question whether I was even a Christian. You know, they're like, you can't be a Christian and have us question the Bible. Amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I think they call that internalized racism, right? Or, I mean, this is like a theological version of internalizing the racism. It's like, oh yeah, my people are worse than white people. Yeah, that's a stage in racial awareness development. I learned it in one of my classes, but it's just like a theological version of that, but it's of course tied up with race and empire and all of that stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely, it is. Well, I know you've got something to go do. I don't want to.
I got homework and a pregnant wife,
and a kid. Yeah, you got a kid on the way. I don't have any kids on the way. My kids are grown and gone, so I can take that to the bank, man.
Yeah.
But listen, this has been absolutely amazing. I've just had a great time talking to you, Dan. How can people find you? That was my last question before I let you go.
Yeah. So the podcast is called You Have Permission. It's anywhere you get podcasts. Mm-hmm. And I'm on Instagram at Dan Koch, the way my name is. Koch, C-O-K-E, like the drink on Instagram. D-A-N-C-O-K-E, if you want to follow me on there.
Right. Great. Thank you so much, Dan. I've absolutely had a great time talking to you. When I'm in Seattle next, I will totally look you up, man. I'm coming hopefully this summer. So we'll sit down. We'll have a pint. We'll put the world to rights over a pint.
Too bad we can't have like a nice British bitter because can't get that here.
I can bring you something. How about that?
Yes.
That totally works. I will bring you something from Great Britain. Good. And we'll have there's some good beers in Seattle though. Don't
That's true. You know. We have our own.
Oh yeah.
My favorite is the British bitter, and it's very hard to find here.
I'll tell you what, you come visit us, you can stay with us, and we'll do a pub crawl. How's that sound?
Oh, now we're talking.
Now we're talking. Yeah. All right, Dan, thank you so much. I will talk to you later, man.
Thanks, man.